Well, in thinking about what seems to be the upcoming execution of Toki Williams, I would like to tell you a story, a Buddhist story. It's, I've been told or read, that it's the second most popular Buddhist story in Thailand, in Theravada countries. The most popular one is a story about the Buddha's life. How he, you know, renounced his palace and went off and became homeless, and how he became enlightened. That's told over and over again. But this other story, the second most popular, is also told over and over again in places like Thailand. They have plays that they put on for it, and pageants, and you know, stories and paintings, and it's very popular. But it's almost never discussed here in the West. And the reason I'm going to tell you this story is not exactly for the sake of the story, but for the sake of my interpretation of the story. So it is an interpretation you're going to get at the end. But it begs an interpretation. Maybe you'll have your own. And the story is about a prince, whose name Visantara. And Visantara, as soon as he could do anything, as a young baby, young kid, young boy, seemed to be precociously or obsessively generous. And he just seemed to start to give things away. Just giving things away. Whatever he had, he would give to people and give. And it really was remarkable how generous and how freely this young kid would give things away. And as he got older, he was known for his tremendous generosity. But he started giving away things which were not his own. And I don't exactly remember the story, but I think there was an elephant that wasn't exactly the royal elephant, it was the national elephant, belonged to the whole country, but the king was in charge of it, and he gave away the royal elephant. And the people got very upset about this because it wasn't his to give away. It belonged to the whole country and shouldn't give us away. And eventually he got married and had children, and he continued as a prince to just give away things. And it became such a problem for the people of the country that eventually the king had to exile his son and his family. And he was sent into exile, into beyond the borders of the country, into go to some other place. And there they went. They went beyond the borders of the country and took up residence deep in some jungle, in some forest, built a hut and lived there in the hut, kind of very simple lives living there. And this other person, I think maybe he was a Brahmin, heard about this Visantara, who was so generous to a fault, seemingly. He seemed to give everything away, went free freely, had perfected generosity, just freely given, and thought he would go there to where he was living with his wife and his two young children. And the Brahmin came and I think maybe had a sad story to tell and asked if he could please have Visantara's wife and children. And maybe as slaves, or I'm not sure exactly how the story went, but he wanted them to be given to him. And Visantara gave his wife and children away to this Brahmin, and off they went. Now, when this story is often told, as I've been told, as I've read in different sources, in places like Thailand, people often cry. People are often quite upset by this story. It's a very painful story to listen to. So it's not, you know, so it's a difficult story here. He gives away his wife and his children. Well, it's kind of a fable, this story, because it turns out that the Brahmin was really the god Brahma in disguise, the great god Zeus of the pantheon, who had heard about this tremendous generosity of Visantara and wanted to come down and test it. And when he took the wife and children away, but then he brought them back, and you know, somehow reinstated him back in his country as prince, and eventually became king, and they all lived happily ever after. So it has a happy ending in that way. But I think that ending is kind of not so interesting, and it's kind of like the fairy tale aspect of the story kind of kicked in. And sometimes the interpretation of it is that this is the perfection of generosity. That in order to cultivate a very deep spiritual life in Buddhism, you have to perfect your generosity, and up to the point of even giving away your children and your wife, your spouse. So that's kind of one traditional interpretation. My interpretation of the story is, for in order to Visantara to mature and actually perfect his spiritual life for who he was, I'm not saying everybody has to do it for who he was, he had to make a colossal mistake. And only with that colossal mistake could he somehow discover a depth in his heart, a depth of maybe humility and a depth of compassion, which would allow him to perfect his spiritual life. And as the story is told, Visantara is the person who, in his next lifetime, would become the Buddha. In Buddhism, you have all these lifetimes of practice and training that prepare a person to become a Buddha. And in the last lifetime before he became a Buddha, according to my interpretation, he had to make a really big mistake. And somehow that mistake cracked his heart, opened his heart, did something that gave birth to the kind of compassion that is required for someone to become a Buddha. Have you ever made mistakes? Probably just a few of you, right? And have you learned from them? Have you been humbled by it? Has your understanding of others and the struggles other people go through and the difficulties kind of been awakened by your own mistakes and own problems and difficulties you've had? Has it awoken your capacity for compassion and caring of others? Have you made a mistake yourself? A big mistake. So inherent in the Buddha's teachings of Buddhism is the idea that people can change. And that's inherent because the whole enterprise of Buddhism is involved in one perspective about bringing about change in the human heart. To bring about liberation, to bring about freedom, to uproot to the forces of greed, hate, and delusion. To bring about the opposite of greed, hate, and delusion. To bring about certainly generosity, love, wisdom. And that Buddhism is based on the premise that it's possible to somehow transform ourselves in not just mild ways, not just simple ways, but in very deeply rooted, radical ways. Deep, radical transformation of our hearts, our minds, our consciousness, of our identity. So another story that's fairly popular in Buddhism is the story of Angulimala. And I think it's in England, maybe some of you know, in England, there's a network of Buddhist groups or Buddhist practitioners and then teachers and stuff who go there, but Buddhist groups, meditators, in the prison systems in England. And this network, I think it's there in England, it's called the Angulimala. They take that their name from the character of this very famous Buddha story. And Anguli means finger, like fingers on the hand. And mala is the kind of the rosary, the Buddhist rosary, its necklace. So it's the necklace of fingers. And that was his nickname because he was a mass murderer in the time of the Buddha. And from every one of his victims, he took a finger and he strung it on his necklace, which then he went around with. Pretty gruesome. And he's killed many people, the story goes, and sent terror in the hearts of the villagers and people. And apparently he was setting out to commit some particularly grievous murder. One story I've heard is that, you know, what could be more grievous than anybody else? But the story was he was going to kill his mother. And the Buddha heard wind of this, and he said, I'll go into the woods where Angulimala is and somehow address him. People said, oh, don't go in there, you know, because he'll kill you too. But the Buddha went into the woods, and Angulimala saw the Buddha coming. And he said, oh, great. These are these, you know, these monk types. They go undefended. They have no weapons. They can't fight. They're not allowed to fight. This will be easy. So he set off after the Buddha to add his finger to his collection. And as he was walking through the jungle following the Buddha didn't vary his pace. He just kept walking, maybe in a quiet, dignified way down through the jungle, down jungle path. And Angulimala, no matter how fast he walked, ended up getting further and further away. He couldn't catch up to him. And so finally, Angulimala yelled out, stop! And the Buddha continued walking, but he said over his shoulder, he said, I stopped long ago. Why don't you? And this caught Angulimala's attention. And, you know, kind of touched him in some way or did something to his mind that nothing else had ever done. And then he became the Buddha's student. And the story is that the understanding here is that when the Buddha said, Buddha didn't physically stop walking. He kept physically walking. But what he stopped was he stopped the greed and the hate and delusion in his own heart. And when he asked Angulimala, why don't you stop also? He was challenging him, saying, you can do this also. This is also a possibility for you. So Angulimala not only became the Buddhist student, but then became a Buddhist monk. Shortly thereafter, the king of the realm decided to do something about this mass murderer. And so he gathered a very large army in order to go into the jungle. We felt he was safe and went to the jungle and uproot and probably kill this Angulimala. And with his entourage, the king came into the forest and found the Buddha, where the Buddha was camped, and came up to the Buddha. The Buddha was sitting there, and he had an attendant monk behind him who was fanning him. It was probably a very hot day, so he was being fanned. And the Buddha and the king came up and paid his respect to the Buddha and said, we're here in the forest in order to find Angulimala. Have you seen him? And the Buddha didn't reply directly, but he said to the king, what would you do if you found out that Angulimala had renounced his evil ways and had ordained as a monk, taken up the holy life? And the king said, oh, in that case, I would bow to him. And then the Buddha said, well, this attendant behind me, fanning me, this is Angulimala. And then the story goes that the king's hair stood up on end. But true to his word, the king left Angulimala alone. And Angulimala went on to become an arhat, to become fully enlightened. And what's interesting about this story is that later, Angulimala goes into the village, some village where he had apparently maybe killed some people. And he went as a monk for his alms. When people saw him there, they threw stones at him. And he got hurt, injured. He came back to the Buddha and said, look, you know, look at me. And the Buddha said something like, well, what do you expect? You know, this is your karma. You know, you set something in motion and your karma is coming back to you. Even being enlightened doesn't free you necessarily from that karma. So here, you know, the both stories, you know, talking about change, possibility of change. And here on Galimala, it's the possibility of, from a Buddhist point of view, the most radical change possible to liberation. Someone who did such awful things. So the tendency in Buddhism is to believe or to see human nature in that capacity, to see that human beings can change. We have to see it that way because otherwise there's no hope for us. And there can be radical change as possible. A friend of mine was involved in the anti-war protests during the Vietnam War times. And she would go to protests and demonstrations. And she went to one at San Francisco State. And there was this police line, maybe a riot police line, lined up, kind of blocking the demonstrators or doing something. And then there was a crowd of demonstrators up against the police line. And she was kind of somehow squeezed up between demonstrators behind her and up against one police officer. And they couldn't avoid each other. They were there, like they were, you know, there with each other. And they looked into each other's eyes. And she saw something in the police officer's eyes that changed her life forever. And because of this, she eventually found Buddhist practice and became not only a Buddhist practitioner, but eventually a Zen priest, and now a senior Zen teacher at a Zen center. But that was a pivotal moment in her life, looking into, for her, I think, the enemy's eyes. You know, this police officer. You know, and seeing something there in his eyes that changed her. And I don't know what that is. I never asked her for the details. What did you see there? But maybe you can imagine. What can you see in another person's eyes when you really have to see them? When you have to stop seeing them as a police officer or as the enemy, whatever projection that you might have for that poor person. But you really can you see the person's humanity, to see the person's maybe not so different than you, to have some kind of veil, or some kind of sense of separation drop away and be right there, kind of that kind of closeness. What is that like? So she was changed. We have no idea about the police officer, but she was changed. And so what is it like when we kind of allow ourselves to look into someone's eyes? And I know it's very easy for people not to want to do that, to turn away. We do it all the time, I think, on the streets, in the stores, all kinds of situations. But to take the time to really stop and really do something like equivalent to really looking someone deep in the eyes, to see their humanity, to see into their heart, to see what, who they really are. What happens to us then? Many years ago, I decided, one of the things that contributed to me becoming a vegetarian when I did, when I was 19 or 20, was I felt that in order to eat meat, I had to be at least willing to butcher my own animals. And I felt I couldn't do that. Sit there and look the cow in the eye and say, you know, bye-bye. I just couldn't do it. It seemed right. It seemed kind of hypocritical then to, you know, if I couldn't kill, to let someone else do it for me. So what is it to kind of look at someone and really take them in? So I was at Spirit Rock today at a meeting of the Spirit Rock teachers. And at the end of the meeting, there was a little dedication of merit for the meeting. And then someone also wanted to include dedication, part of the merit to Toki Williams. And as soon as someone said that, one of the other teachers said, with a certain kind of heaviness, and also for the executioner, the person who probably tonight is going to do the injection. And when he said that, you know, it was out of a tremendous sense of compassion for the person who has to do this job, or is going to do this job. I don't know if they have to, but is going to do this job. That from the Buddhist point of view, it's tremendously costly for the person who has to do it, do the execution. the karmic effects, the effects on the heart and the mind of someone who, actually does this, is so, you know, it's one of the worst things you can do to your own heart. And so there's a sense of compassion for that person. Concern for that person. So generally the Buddhist idea, I think, is to be against capital punishment, to allow for the possibility of some kind of change. Because we believe in change. So how do you set into the conditions for change? And to some degree you see that belief is also present in how Governor Schwarzenegger has renamed the prison system in California to include the word rehabilitation as part of the name. What is it now? Corrections and rehabilitation? And I think that's a big change. Just, you know, to recognize the possibility of rehabilitation as part of it. One of the person who was the first Buddhist king, King Ashoka, had been a very bad king, killed a lot of people in war, and then renounced war and kind of lived pretty much humanitarian, a very compassionate life as a king. Created hospitals and all kinds of wonderful things, took care of animals. But from what I can learn, he did not abolish capital punishment. He still allowed for it in some cases. However, he did something which writers about this say was very radical for his time. And that is, I guess executions, they didn't have appeal systems back then. You know, years and years of appeals and waiting. It was much quicker. But he would give the condemned 3 days in order to meditate and somehow try to turn their life around so that when they died, that their karma was changed enough that they would have some good possibility for how they continued after their death, their rebirth. So, the offering a merit to the executioner, but it's also there's offering a merit to the other people involved somehow. There's a huge network, large number of people involved in the decision. That somehow must be weighing on them to some degree, I imagine. The jury, everybody, judges and everyone involved, including the governor. And I thought it was very interesting what I heard on the radio about the governor's statement. I think one of the arguments for Toki Williams argument for giving him clemency was because of believing in redemption, he'd been redeemed. I said to back up a little bit, and so it's very interesting that we have this system in California where a governor can offer clemency, and I think it's probably it's very I think it's very interesting because it's the role of the courts to follow, I think, mostly the letter of the law. And so to decide whether there's guilt or innocence. But guilt and innocence and the law doesn't, in and of itself, look at the human side of things so well. So the idea of redemption, once the guilt has been decided, I don't know if the courts, are going to decide whether someone's redeemed enough to somehow be forgiven or be granted some kind of clemency. So there's this kind of clause, this kind of opening in the system to allow for someone who is not part of the legal system to have some other criteria for understanding the situation. So it allows certainly possibility for someone to measure or look at, has a person somehow redeemed him or herself? Has a person been changed? Has a person been transformed enough that what was decided before, the judgment before, somehow doesn't apply or is not relevant or needs to be relevant in a different way? And so So it kind of adds a kind of human heart element to this whole kind of legal system. At least that's the hope. I hope it involves. I don't know if this is a logical connection, but in the old days, like in the Middle Ages, someone who was in trouble with law, if they could make it to the church or to a monastery, then they'd be left there, and the king couldn't get in there and kill them or do what they had to do. But there was refuge in the church and sacred land. Like, then they'd have to stay there for years. They couldn't leave because then they would, you know, or stay for a long time. But to have some place where there's some refuge, some alternative, some way of looking at another kind of set of values, I think is you know, really, really important. So what is that other value? What is that other place? How does it operate? What are the laws? What are the rules that govern that? How do we make that work as a society? How do we acknowledge it? How do we look at it? But so then there's Governor Horsnager, who had this, must have been horrendous. At least, you know, if I imagine myself in his shoes, that would be easy for me, I think. Because I don't have to look for redemption. I have a pretty strong view about capital punishment. So, but then they wouldn't elect me. So, I think must be a very hard. I imagine it's a very hard position to be in. But he said something other very interesting today. Probably some of you heard it on the radio. And he was addressing this issue of redemption. And if he's going to base his consideration of the matter build it on what the courts had decided, and the courts had decided that Toki Williams was guilty, and there's lots of questions about whether he really was or not, right? But anyway, if he's going to base it, at least go along with the courts that far, then he had to look at what is redemption then, given that he's assuming that he's guilty. And then Schwarzenegger said, well, if he's guilty, then redemption has to take the form that he feels remorse and guilt for the murders that happened. And without that feeling, that apology and that remorse, there is no real redemption. So that's pretty interesting. I think it's actually, in some ways quite profound. That there has to be, that turning in the heart has to be also. But then there's a question, maybe he didn't do it. He says he didn't do it. So it's kind of like, is the situation just a huge tragedy? He's being honest, I didn't do it. But Governor Schwarzenegger has, can't make any other choice because he has to base his assumption on the fact that the courts are right. The verdict was right. So it's a tragedy. I don't think it's a tragedy no matter what. It's a tragedy what happened a long time ago. It's a tragedy what Toki Williams did in his youth. It's a tragedy what that's created. It's a tragedy for us in California now. It's a tragedy, at least in my mind, that there's an execution going to happen. It's a tragedy for me, it's a tragedy, I hope, for all of you, that it's state-sponsored. Because in some ways, there's murders happening all the time. But somehow, I don't know how clean any of our hands are then, because it's kind of like in our name. So what is that? And some people are, probably delighting in that. They feel it's really right. That's the case. But I hope that even people who feel that capital punishment is right will have a deep sense of the tragedy, the tragedies, all the networks of tragedies that are going on. And that part of what we do is, hopefully as human beings, and certainly as Buddhist practitioners, is that in looking deeply into the eyes of the other, deeply into the situation, that we're willing to stay present for the sense of tragedy. And not flippantly or callously or fearfully turn away from the tragedy. I'm not going to deal with this. It's someone else's problem. or to assign blame, just get angry. Anger sometimes is a way of avoiding just sitting with a tragedy or rationalizing. One of the previous times California executed someone, many years ago, I gave a talk on, I felt like I couldn't do anything else but talk about that since it was so up, but that the evening before. And it was a very powerful moment. We had a question and answer session, and there was discussions about a little bit about the death penalty, and maybe some pros and cons went on in the discussion. And then a man who was here stood up and he said, "You know, in my life, I found myself on both sides of this question of being about the death penalty, because both my parents were murdered. But the person who murdered them and then received the death penalty was my brother." So imagine that. So where are you then? Tragedy. So are we always our brothers and sisters for ourselves, for each other? So I think that one of the ideas in Buddhism, I hope, is that when there's tragedy, that there's some willingness to sit in the middle of it. And I think that that willingness, I think, involves a certain kind of spiritual strength. I quoted yesterday morning Martin Luther King, who said, I got to paraphrase it now, but the measure of a person's character is not where they stand in times of comfort and ease. Measure of a person's character is where they stand or how they stand in times of change and controversy. So to sit there with a sense of tragedy, and what, you know, I think that to witness it, for example, and perhaps allow that to be the seeds or the fuel for our compassion and for our motivation and care. Visantara, the generous prince, had to sit with his tragedy, his big mistake, and it transformed him, in my interpretation, so that he became a Buddha. So collectively as a society, do we allow ourselves to receive and take in the pain? Not so that we are victims of it, but rather so that in some way it strengthens us, it matures us, and allows us to respond to the world in the wisest and most compassionate way. So I've read in the paper that there's a variety of people. Basically, in the paper, there's, you know, two big camps of people who are standing vigil or outside of San Quentin. There's the people who are against the death penalty and the people who are for it. And I know that Jack Kornfield is right now, he has his Monday night sitting group, and he's talking about this there now. And he's encouraging his group to go to San Quentin tonight. He's going to go himself and be outside the gates. So so the papers talk about people for and people against. But I think there's also a place for a third category of people. And what both this category can be both for, you know, can be people who are for it or against it, but people who are going to be there at the gates just to be a witness, just to be there and take it in. So it's not something that we forget or ignore or don't really take in and experience as a society. So taking in, you know, pain like this kind of tragedy. In order to do that in a wise way, in a useful way, in a spiritual way, I think we have to allow it to motivate us. If we're not motivated by the tragedy, then I don't think the tragedy has had an effect. So to motivate us, for us to change, we can all change. So the question is, how do you want to change? What kind of change would you like for your life? How you live your life? What kind of change would you like to have for your society that you live in? And what will you do for that? Will you do anything? One of my favorite stories, theistic stories, is the person who went to heaven and complained to God about the state of the world. It can be an easy thing to do. And the person, after complaining about the terrible state of the world and suffering and holocausts and all these things, the person said to God, "You should do something about it." And God said, "I did do something about it. I made you." I think it's a very profound story. So to be motivated to do something. And it could be in the smallest ways. I like to believe that huge tragedies, like the four murders that happened 25 years ago, that somehow Toki Williams is somehow connected to, or the creation of the Crips, that all these kinds of events, if you trace back the cause and effect and the cause and effect, there was probably some very innocent and simple beginning. Someone was slighted, someone was unkind to someone else. And then it grows and grows and festers and becomes really big. So in our lives today, you know, the people who are born in Redwood City today, what are the small changes? What are the small ways in which we try to create a better city, a better society, so that in 18 years and 20 years and 25 years, they don't become gang members? What is it, what we need to do now to think ahead? And I think it's a Buddhist view, this wonderful religion that seemingly teaches us be here now. I think it's also very Buddhist to actually have some vision of the future and to realize some sense the cause and effect network that reaches out into the future. And what we do now helps create that future. There's a wonderful book about Buddhist ethics that's titled "For a Future to be Possible." So what future do we want? So I hope that that events like this, if they can't be stopped, that as we take them in as Buddhist practitioners, that our hearts become compost, become a transformer, that somehow transforms what we take in, the pain we take in, and through our motivations and our compassion, that the strength of the pain is transformed and changed into a strength of practice and motivation for the betterment of all. May it be that our practice and how we live with our hearts supports and helps all beings become free, find peace, and become liberated from all suffering. So thank you very much.